Johann Sebastian Bach, the preeminent Lutheran musician, spent his lifetime writing music for Lutheran worship. Much of it used every Sunday in the regular course of the church year. And Bach was steeped in Luther's theology. In fact, in many of his manuscripts, he wrote quotations from Luther as he was writing. He was a brilliant man, of course, a genius, I guess we'd say. And one of the things that Bach is known for are fugues. Heard any fugues lately? Yeah, more likely to hear Beyoncé. The fugue is an interesting form of composition. There's a central theme, and then it gets elaborated all kinds of different directions. And Bach was a master at this, the art of the fugue. The key to the fugue is not to lose the essential line, to keep it going. Even though it may fly off in many directions, the important thing is to keep the theme intact. You've probably also noticed that there are many versions of the Christian faith around these days, which is putting it mildly. And so the question can be rightly asked, what is the theme? What is it that we are about? Now, in good American fashion, many would say, well, it doesn't really matter. Religion is like a salad bar, right? You just pick a little of this and a little bit of that, and you kind of construct your own. That's the American way. Well, that may be the American way, but it certainly is not what Lutherans believe. Part of confessing the faith is having to take a position. That's what confessing means. Our denomination, our church tradition, began with a lone Christian who stood up to the church and said, no, this is where I stand. And as hard as it was and as much as it pained him, he had to stand against much of what his church taught and confessed and believed. This is an age when that's a hard road to walk, isn't it? We are challenged by our culture at every turn to be inclusive, accepting, go along and to get along, to let other people have what they want and not bother with them. It's very interesting to note that in that respect, this age is more like the first century than any century since. For the Roman world was exactly like that. The vast Roman Empire was a very inclusive state. They conquered peoples of many tribes and nations, but permitted them to keep their religions, and in some respects, to keep their forms of government over which the Romans ruled, sometimes benignly, sometimes with a heavy hand. Point is that the early Christian church also lived in a society that said, just go along. And you're all familiar, of course, with the famous requirement that the Romans made for the Christians, for all their citizens, go to the temple, throw incense on the altar, and swear allegiance to the emperor as supreme God. Do that, you'll get you a piece of paper signed, which they did. You can roll that up and take it home with you, and it's all good. Seems simple, doesn't it? What's wrong with that? I mean, if you and I were faced with persecution, threat of losing our lives, our families, well, you weigh it in the balance, well, you know, what's it going to hurt? I mean, I can believe in my heart, right? I can make an outward pretense of being a Roman, of honoring the emperor as God, but inwardly, I will keep Jesus to myself as Lord. Maybe you would do that. I don't know. Interesting that the early Christians didn't do that. Some did, but many didn't. Many didn't to the point where they were willing to lose their lives rather than deny Christ. In this kind of climate today, for many people, that seems almost unimaginable. Come on, It's just religion. Don't get so worked up. Don't take it so seriously. You know? Nobody's going to die over wanting carrots on the salad bar when somebody else wants lettuce. It's just a choice. Go along, get along. This is the great temptation at the center of faith, to abandon the uniqueness of Christ and to embrace the generosity of the world and its works and its ways. In the first century, St. Paul had to deal with this problem. It shows up most clearly in the letters to the Corinthian church. The Corinthian congregation began splintering and organizing themselves around their pastors. Now, we have a pretty small congregation here, and it's kind of hard to get the opposition moving, even if there is any. But in large congregations, it's not so hard. If you have two or three pastors in a congregation, people naturally gravitate toward one or the other, which is fine. You know, that's not unusual. But sometimes it goes to the point where folks will say, well, we're for Pastor so-and-so, and we're not for him or her. And this pastor ought to be the head pastor, and that guy ought to go, or at least take a back seat. And so you get these kind of church wars. They go on all the time. They're going on right now as we speak somewhere. So Paul's got a pastoral problem here with this congregation. And what he has to do is he has to reestablish the theme. What are we here for? What's important? What is at the center that is non-negotiable? The message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but for us who are being saved, it is the power of God. Paul also goes on to say in Corinthians, I was determined to know nothing among you except Christ and him crucified, to preach nothing but the message of the cross. This is the continuing, perpetual challenge that faces the church in every generation. For whether it was 2,000 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 100 years ago, or in our present time, there are constantly voices within the church that want something else to be the message. Today, we have vast numbers of congregations and some denominations for whom the message is not the cross of Christ, it is peace and justice. It is adopting the social agenda and moving against the world where injustice appears. Well, that's an easy one to sell, isn't it? Because injustice is everywhere. It seems to pop up like mushrooms, you know. Just when you think you've got it cleared away, it's back again. And justice is also appealing to us sinners because it feels like we're doing something. We're engaged in something meaningful. We can get our hands around something important and we can contribute. And of course, what could be wrong with that? We have lots of injustices in the world that need to be addressed. And they come in all forms and varieties. And if this is something that you have any interest in, there's nothing stopping you. Go right ahead. And as I said before, you won't have to worry about getting into a stampede either. Take it on wherever you would like. St. Paul doesn't talk about any of this when he speaks of what the theme is. Because Paul understood that the preaching of the church is directed to the people who are sitting in front of the word. Period. And that means you this morning who have come into this place. God has arranged it in such a way that we are here this morning. And the word that has been given to us to hear and to me to proclaim to you is the word that on the cross 2,000 years ago, blood was shed, sins were forgiven for you. The message of the cross finally has to be spoken to the sinner. Only then is its central work done. And the theme played out loudly and clearly. When Luther began his work, as he began to reflect upon and think about the life of the church and his own particular role as a Christian, he struggled with questions like this. What is it that is central? What is it that can bring to people a gracious God? The church has always been very good at telling us what to do, how to live our lives, offering suggestions for living, giving us projects, moral and otherwise, to get our hands around and get busy with. And while all of those things may have a place, Luther understood that is not what the scriptures tell us about the work and the role of the church. The primary business of the church is to proclaim that on the cross, the future is laid up before us. Your life and the world are not progressing. They are coming to an end. That is the first word from the cross. Yesterday morning, I was in a cemetery in Wisconsin. It was raining, drizzling, and I was searching for my father's grave, who was buried in April. Grass had grown, they hadn't been cut for a while, and as I slipped around among the gravestones, flat, laying on the earth, I struggled to find it. And as I moved through these graves, I began to read one after another, after another, after another, after another, after another, for almost a half an hour, wandering along this hillside. Men, women, children, young, old. The message of the cross of Jesus is not that he identifies with us poor victims in our suffering. The message of the cross, first and foremost to us, is that sin is so important to God. It is so devastating, so completely at odds with God's purposes, that he has pronounced death upon every last one of us, and it will be carried out. Finally, I had to go over to the mausoleum and get a schematic where all the graves were. And then I could zero in, and finally there I came upon the headstone laying there on the ground. And it read, Brigadier General Chaplain Carol N. Anderson, World War II, few other things. As I stood there, I looked down and I spoke. And I said, Dad, you preached all your life that it would come to this. And so it has. That is the first and hard word of the cross that, frankly, many in our generation simply do not want to hear. So we have prosperity Christianity. We have success Christianity. We have megachurch Christianity, promising the world. But have you noticed how seldom it actually shows up? Because it's simply untruthful. Paul understood that the message that saves us is the truth of God's word to us, that because of this disease of sin that we have, this sickness unto death, there will be no final future here. And so on the cross, the first thing that God does is he indicts us. He moves against us and promises that the wages of sin will be death, as Paul writes in Romans. It's having that sober realization, and only that, that brings sinners to their senses. To realize that the holy God of the universe is not a benign grandfather winking at this scandalous, corrupt world. But he is a passionate, merciful, loving God who gave us nothing but life, poured out his love in the universe, and this tiny planet and this creature upon it and this tiny little corner of the galaxy has stolen its existence from him, and the results are predictable. At the same time, For those of us who are being saved, to use Paul's language, those of us for whom the gospel of Jesus Christ is a life-giving word, the cross is a message of hope, mercy, and promise. For even as God moved against us in the dying Jesus, as the blood flowed out of him, he spoke for us, didn't he? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And 3 days later, that word of grace and mercy was vindicated, as was the judgment when Jesus arose. And now he lives and reigns in his word, in the sacraments, in his people. As God moves through time in this gospel, calling, gathering, enlightening, and sanctifying those whom he chooses, and preparing them for a world that is yet to come. The message about the cross, the message of the cross, the proclamation of the cross must be the central theme, because anything else simply leaves us to ourselves, puts life in our hands, promises futures that we will never be able to deliver. The cross takes all of that out of our hands, and God swallows up sin and death, the powers that are too much for us, that are set against us, that will one day have us. And in Jesus Christ promises a new day, a new life that begins now and will be brought to perfection in the life to come. So today, in this place, I declare to you, Jesus Christ died on the cross for your sin. He died even though we deserve it. He died to take upon himself the burden of your existence and your life. And on that third day when he was raised, he came out of that tomb in the power of God's mighty Spirit for you. That those who are called and who believe in this Christ, who have received in the waters of baptism and in the promise of the gospel that new life-giving word, that you might know a promising future. That each day may open with new possibilities. That even though so much of life seems more than we can handle and stacked against us, nonetheless, we dare to trust that God's power and promise is greater than all. And is that not what we must say as we look at the cross? That sign of defeat, failure, suffering, and death? And is that now how you and I, also as Christian people, must look at our own defeats and failures and suffering and finally death? And so I laid the flowers on the grave. And I thought about the cross that my father had preached so long, and said, as I just indicated, you knew it would come to this. But I said, you also knew, Dad, that Jesus came out of his grave. And so I do not walk away from this place overwhelmed with sadness, although it was there, still is. But I could say also, we will meet again on a distant shore in a greater light because of the incredible and amazing grace of God, who so loved the world that he gave himself, that we might not perish, but have life everlasting. This is the promise of your baptism. Trust it. Believe it. It is for you. Amen.